Rick, this is why we schedule podcasts for 3 hours, you know?
Oh, I know. Wouldn't you know it?
Here we go. You ready to rock and roll?
Sure.
Rick, I appreciate you doing this, man. I'm been dying to have you on.
Well, thanks for having me.
So where are you calling from? Where do you call home?
I'm in Albuquerque, New Mexico right now. I moved here in May. I was living in the western part of the state, a small town called Gallup, New Mexico. I was out there 14 years.
Favorite New Mexico food? You travel all over. What food do you miss the most coming back to New Mexico?
A chicken burrito with green chili.
Now, Doc, here's the deal. I've had on, you can see the jerseys behind me, astronauts, Major League Baseball Hall of Famers, NFL Super Bowl champions, you name it, NBA players. Never once has my brother came on or probably listened to or watched my podcast. He actually, you're the only guest he's ever requested to come on.
Oh,
so
really?
Finally, you come on, and it's the first time he's ever on my podcast, so I want to introduce you to my co-host today, my brother Jason. So,
well, hello, Jason.
How are you, Rick? Huge, huge honor and pleasure to speak to you, man. I came across your book, The Spirit Molecule, probably 2 or 3 months ago, and consumed it like it was a page-turning mystery. Devoured the entire book in about 2 or 3 days. Great, great book. Very interesting subject matter. Got me very interested in DMT in general. I'm a huge, huge nerd in the medical field specifically. And the whole idea of psychedelic psychotherapy has fascinated me for a while now. And your book has really, really turned the page and got me more into it and more into the subject matter itself.
Yeah, yeah, very cool. Yeah,
fantastic book, man.
Yeah, what do you think of all those stories?
I was texting my brother as I'm reading it, like, dude, this is the most amazing thing ever. We have to find this. We need to try it. This is the most out of this world experience I've ever read about in my life.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard to describe.
Yeah, and Rick, he actually gave me the book, so I have the book right here. But we have to address the elephant in the room. Rick, I've never tried a drug in my life. I mean that. I've never smoked weed. I've never done anything besides drink beer. Jay, on the other hand.
I've dabbled from here and there. Extensive history. More, unfortunately, narcotics-based. Had a pretty bad opiate addiction for quite a while. My psychedelics experience, kind of novice, MDMA, ketamine, mushrooms here and there. Never did any of the, I guess, call them like the classic psychedelics, LSD, mescaline, or DMT. So I don't have that, you know, crazy, crazy experience. My most psychedelic experience was IV ketamine use. And same thing, it was an out of body, very out of the world experience.
And now, Rick, because I want to get into all that. So again, him being kind of an expert on it, me being the amateur, we're going to put it all together. But your book has literally changed the world. It saves lives, changing people's quality of life. So let's get the plug in for your newest book, My Altered States, A Doctor's Extraordinary Account of Trauma, Psychedelics, and Spiritual Growth. Congratulations on the new book.
Well, thank you.
As an author, have you ever seen anyone reading your book in public?
No, I haven't. You know, but the first time I met Joe Rogan, it was a phone call.
Okay.
I called him. I had, you know, heard that he was promoting the book when it first came out in the early 2000s. Yeah, and I called him, and he was at the LA airport, and he was reading the book. So, that's the closest I've come, to seeing anybody read one of my books.
Now, obviously, we're going to talk about your studies and everything, but a little backstory on you. We know about your current life. You grew up in the 60s in California. Was that the whole beach chill vibe, like just a great upbringing you loved?
It was pretty comfortable. Yeah, yeah. The beach during the summer, body surfing, working on my tan. I ran track. My girlfriend and I at the time were voted the cutest couple in the graduating class. Yeah. So the full meal deal from the San Fernando Valley in the late 50s, early 60s.
Always into science and chemistry growing up, experimenting or not really?
I really liked chemistry when I was a kid. I got chemistry sets for Hanukkah. I set up a little corner in our garage and I made stinky things and colorful things. Then I graduated to, things that burned, smoked, kind of exploded. Yeah, so... by the time I was in high school, I was making bombs and a lot of gunpowder in my garage.
Now, you're a Bruin, right? UCLA?
I was a Trojan fan for football. Basketball for UCLA.
And if my math is correct, you went to school and college around the 70s. Did that impact your future life? The 70s, counterculture, the hippie life, drugs, did that play a role in your life? Like, were you involved in that whole scene?
I was never much of a hippie. I did, grow my hair to, long enough to get a, pigtail. It didn't look that good. And I had a beard and a mustache and pretty scruffy hair, but I was always a student. I never lived in a commune or hit the road. I mean, meditation was coming into the US via the West Coast back then. Psychedelics were, very popular in the late 60s, early 70s, just in beginning to make an impact. So both of those influenced me. My first cannabis experience actually was quite psychedelic. And I think that was the first hint that I would study psychopharmacology, just because it was, it was a remarkable change in my psychology that was brought about by a drug, which is, basically psychopharmacology. And
What
my
was
interest,
it
yeah.
about your first time you got high? What was so special about it? 'Cause I never smoked weed, so I don't know that high feeling. I never knew that the first feeling would be psychedelically.
It can be. It was a fairly strong, Middle Eastern hashish, which is high concentrate of THC and other ingredients. The speakers in my room were emitting purple clouds. I was ecstatic. My inner, criticism, my inner monologue just went away. I perceived things in the music I had never even dreamed of before, like the space between, sounds and the space in which, sound exists. And also, there was the influx of Eastern religions, which influenced my, religious and spiritual, worldview and activities for quite a long time. So, I was, certainly a child of the 60s.
And my brother told me about, remember, beyond an amateur, beyond a novice in this whole world, but I'm a curious and questioning person. Your clinical studies with DMT in the 90s, besides being groundbreaking and pioneering and fascinating, they really changed the world. But before I talk about how the hell you got the US government to fund this, which is still blowing my mind, can you explain to me exactly what exactly is DMT?
Well, it's a chemical, it's a molecule, and it's not especially big or complex. It's related to serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter. It's also related pharmacologically and structurally, like it's a chemical formula, to melatonin. It exists throughout the natural world. It's been identified in hundreds, if not more, plants. And every mammal that's been studied seems to have DMT, in its system. It's also the visionary ingredient in ayahuasca, which is a popular brew, a psychedelic brew from the Amazon. It's included in what's called the classical psychedelics, which include LSD, psilocybin, and mescaline. Their pharmacology is, quite similar. They activate, similar parts of the brain. DMT needs to be either injected or smoked. It isn't active orally. And so when you inject it or smoke it, it starts working within a few heartbeats and it peaks at about, 2 to 5 minutes. And you're coming down at about the 10 to 12 minute point and you're pretty normal at a half hour. So it's remarkable with respect, to the time course. It's quite striking.
And I remember it's in your body. We all have it in our bodies.
We do, yeah. At first, it was believed to be produced in the lungs. It was a strange anomaly of, pharmacological research. But as, time has gone on, it seems as if the main producer of DMT in the mammal is the brain, and the concentrations are as high as recognized neurotransmitters like serotonin or dopamine. So there is, DMT in the mammalian brain, and the concentrations are quite high.
So you're taking it any way you ingest it, any way you take it now, it's released, makes you high. And I don't want you to laugh at this, but is it like the outer body experiences, the seeing of the colors? Is that what happens to it, to you when you take it?
Well, you lose awareness of your body. And then you enter into this world of light that has nothing at all to do with this world. It's quite colorful, lots of figures morphing and buzzing, and it seems to have a great power, and it contains information as well. So it's powerful. It's full of information. Sometimes one encounters these things that I've called beings. Could be an insect or a bird or a robot or another humanoid sort of thing, with which one interacts, often telepathically. There's an exchange of information. Yeah, and all that occurs in about 5 minutes.
That's the craziest part to me. Like the way you're saying, you're starting from nothing, you're peaking within a couple of minutes in this absolute different universe. And then all of a sudden you're back to normal and nothing happened. I'm reading another book now about how the brain kind of processes different world spaces, and kind of how it, like how our normal waking brain sees this as our world space. And then when you take psychedelics, what happens to your brain that it kind of allows it to see other spaces that we don't see in our normal waking life. And it's like you're saying, you're in that DMT space, this crazy colorful with beings and stuff, things that aren't in the room with you normally. That's absolutely fascinating to me.
Well, yeah. And, the $64,000 question is, where does that world reside? Is it outside of us or is it inside of us? Yeah. So, I've thought about that a lot, and I'm not sure it makes all that much of a difference. The main thing I believe is to make the most of whatever information you can bring back with you.
The part that gets me is that the way you're saying, like, that so many people have that very similar experience. Like, if me and somebody else were to take mushrooms in the same room, we would have different experiences. Yet people, all over the world taking DMT are having such similar visions of the beings, that people could have conversations about, like, I've seen this, and other people, oh, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. That's such a unique characteristic of it, I feel like.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, it's amazing that there are not more people studying endogenous or naturally produced DMT. We have got this chemical in our brain, which if you raise the levels by smoking or injecting it or taking ayahuasca, you're transported instantly to this completely seemingly autonomous parallel sort of level of existence. Yeah, and there's like one person, two people studying in endogenous DMT now.
Rick, writing your books and talking to a guy like me, like obviously you and my brother are going back and forth with it. Is it easy for you or is it annoying to dumb it down for guys like me? Like you want to write a book, you're like, okay, I don't want just the psychedelic guys to do it, but I want a dude who's never tried weed to do it. Is it hard for you to dumb it down?
Not really. I mean, I want to make whatever I'm trying to say accessible. So I read out loud whatever I've written to make sure it sounds like it makes sense and, I spend a lot of time editing. Like each chapter I've ever written 11 or 12 edits. So I want to make sure that whatever I'm saying is clear. So I respect the intelligence of my readers, no matter what that educational level might be. I want them to understand everything they can. Yeah, and then I might drift off into some more abstract flights of fancy, but that would maybe be reserved for those with a more technical understanding of things. Like for example, in the spirit molecule, there's a chapter dedicated to the chemistry and the pharmacology of psychedelics. And, some people just skipped over that. It was just, too dense or too academic.
Doing your research, doing all the things you do, is it difficult? Because I'll be honest, my family is a perfect example. My brother experiments with everything. my mom, my aunt, my cousins, like, oh my God, you know, drugs, psychedelics, the war on drugs. Was it a difficult stigma for you guys to overcome in the 90s doing your stuff, knowing that there's a stigma, people hear psychedelics, automatically drugs, you're a drug user?
Well, I mean, it was a carefully crafted strategy that I used. You know, I'd been thinking of studying psychedelics ever since I was in college. And that's one of the reasons I went to medical school, was maybe one day I could study psychedelics. And, you know, if you want to do controversial research, you really need to be qualified. You really need to have been trained. I thought, medical, you couldn't beat medical training, for the exhaustive nature of studying, the human, the mind and the body. And then I trained in psychiatry, which I figured would be the most likely discipline that could make an argument for studying psychedelics again in humans. And I got research, training. During a fellowship after my psychiatry residency. Yeah. And then, did psychopharmacology research with melatonin. So I established myself as being able to get a grant, write papers, analyze data. So by then I was pretty familiar with, the research world, and I knew how to phrase and conceptualize a DMT study in a way that was attractive that might get funded. So yeah, it was a very long project.
Yeah. And is that how the government funded your, the New Mexico stuff? Like, hey, I'm going to test it on people. Is that how you guys, is you kind of worded or parlayed it? All your studies into it?
Yeah. Well, our first funding was from the Scottish Rite Foundation for Schizophrenia Research. It's a branch of the Masons. And after that, I could say, well, I've gotten a private grant, so that, strengthened my application, for federal funding. I got, federal funding from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And, this was, during the first, Bush administration. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I made the argument that, people were still using psychedelics. We didn't really know what they did or how they did it. They're abused, drugs. People, can get into, trouble with a bad psychedelic trip. So I mostly, at least ostensibly, explicitly, I made the argument from a public health point of view. Obviously understanding, the chemistry and the pharmacology was interesting, but the relevance, connected, to a public health concern, which is drug abuse and problems from using drugs.
And you just had people lined up like, hey, inject me. Did you worry about overdosing someone? How did you know how much to give people?
Good question. The majority of old studies in humans giving DMT gave it intramuscularly, and it was about 1 mg/kg intramuscular.
Okay.
But I wanted to approximate the effect of the smoke dose, which is faster than intramuscular. So you can't really smoke DMT on a research unit, but we could give it intravenously, which is as faster, maybe even a bit faster. So we started off at a conservative dose of the intravenous route of administration. Yeah, and it wasn't quite enough, so. I called the FDA and said, what do you suggest? And they said, well, you can go up, two or three times, the dose. So I was feeling rather, confident, and went up, to three times the dose. Yeah. And I overdosed, two people. They both were confused and couldn't remember anything.
Oh, and that was my question. So were there any scares?
That there were a number of scares. Yeah. 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 So we lowered the high dose, down to, twice what we started off with. Yeah, it's interesting, too. There is some interest in doing, DMT research, giving it to humans. But, nobody has gone beyond 0.3 mg/kg, and our high dose was 0.4 mg/kg. So The volunteers liked 0.3, more than any other dose. So that's the one other groups have stuck with. But with that, very high dose, there could be anxiety. There can be like a, like a bad trip. You're frightened. You feel stuck. You might, a couple of people experienced a recurrence of, their depression,
Oof.
which responded, to, brief intervention, but still, the study wasn't, free of risk.
You actually just mentioned two trigger words I want to talk about, anxiety and depression. You talked about it, you wrote about it. It helps with mental health, PTSD, depression. What are the negatives though? And it's going to sound very silly, like it seems very much like too good to be true. It can help with PTSD, depression. What are the negatives with taking stuff like this?
Oh yeah. Well, that's an important point, to emphasize. Is, as you note, everybody is mostly giving, glowing, reports of everything that psychedelics can do. When the wave of renewed interest really was at its peak, you could, see a new thing that psychedelics were doing almost every week or two in the media or in the scientific literature. Yeah, it just seemed as if they were panaceas. There is, any intense experience can lead to, to problems either acutely or, further down the road. It's what's called an adverse effect. Penicillin, you could get a skin rash. That's an adverse effect. With psychedelics, there are adverse effects. They can be acute, which would be fear and paranoia or depression or anxiety during the trip, which resolves, within a few hours after you come down, or it can extend for like 1 or 2 days, or it can extend even, beyond that. The adverse effects can be mild, they could be moderate, or they could be severe. The mild ones would just be a, sense of, some anxiety, which, gradually resolves. But it, could be, more in, more intense than that, with, panic attacks even, which, don't improve, over time. You can get depression, either in the middle or, within the actual experience itself, or afterwards. And you may be able to, shake it off, talk about a therapist with it and get some clarity, or it, might, proceed, along a more, troublesome course. You can feel kind of what's called derealized or depersonalized.
Okay.
You can feel as if your connection to yourself, to other people, to the outside world has been disturbed in an unpleasant way. You're not, certain what's real. What's the point of living? Am I alive or not? Yeah, these are not common side effects, but they're not uncommon. I'd say, probably 10 to 15% of people who take a big psychedelic trip will have, some lingering on your problems.
Two more questions about the trips itself. One, is it a, can you get addicted to it? Like, is it an addictive drug? Like, oh my God, I just had a great high. Let me do it again. Let me keep doing this over and over. Is it an addictive kind of thing or not really?
No, actually, psychedelics, don't cause addiction. There's no withdrawal if you've been, taking it every day, let's say. And what appears to be the case with most of the classical, psychedelics is the very rapid development of tolerance. You take LSD every day for 3 days in a row, and, by, the fourth day, you're barely responding at all, if at all, to the fourth, a similar dose. Yeah, so there is a buildup of tolerance. Big psychedelic experiences too can really shake you up, even in a good way. Doing that repeatedly, just really doesn't make any sense.
Now, one other question. It's going to sound very amateurish, but I'm always curious, a guy like you who studied so much in the 90s, what was like your initial thought till now? Like, holy crap, this changed so much, or what has changed the most throughout the years, or surprised you the most in your research? Because it's a 30 plus year journey, and you're the guy, you're the psychedelic guy.
Well, I mean, our study opened, you know, the door, you know, to other American studies, you know, being able to use, you know, Schedule One psychedelics. You know, our studies were, you know, pharmacological. You know, we weren't interested in, you know, the religious aspects. We weren't, you know, treating you know, patients, you know, with you know, psychiatric disorders. You know, so are you wondering, you know, what surprised me after I wrapped up the research, or, you know, from the research itself?
Well, after finishing the research, you had all these, you know, test people, changing the doses. You went away there thinking what? Like, what shocked you? Like, oh, crap, this worked, or they had the same experience, or we might be onto something.
You know, there were a couple things. You know, one was kind of one was answering one of my, you know, questions that I brought to bear on the study, which was, you know, was there anything intrinsically spiritual about a psychedelic drug? In other words, if he just gave people the drug and said, you know, keep an eye on the experience, come back and report what happened, you know, without any coaching or guidance or, you know, preparation, you know, to have a spiritual experience, would the pharmacology itself, you know, produce a spiritual state? And, you know, I was kind of thinking about it in a utopian sense, you know, like if you can just give a drug and cause people to be enlightened, would that be great for the world? But, you know, lo and behold, it was, you know, way different than that. You know, people, you know, had, you know, purely personal experiences. You know, they had insights into their life. They found the experience pleasurable. They, you know, got some, you know, physical healing, you know, resolution of some career questions, you know, but as far as enlightenment, there just weren't any cases of it. There was one, what you might call a mystical experience. But, you know, this, you know, fellow, you know, was hoping, you know, to have a particular type of experience, was, you know, trained and educated in that mode of understanding what, you know, religion is like. You know, so his experience was, you know, similar to what he was, you know, hoping it would be. But, you know, whether or not, you know, that's a pharmacological enlightenment experience or not is unclear. Other than that, you know, there were no what you might call enlightenment experiences. So, you know, in the back of my mind, I was hoping that might be the case. You know, so that was, you know, one thing which I resolved. It wasn't a surprise, but still, it was, you know, slightly unexpected. Or, you know, like I was hoping against hope, and it didn't quite pan out. You know, the other was the, you know, the sense that the volunteers shared that what they experienced on DMT, like the DMT world, was more real than this one. And I wasn't quite prepared, you know, for the firm nature of that assertion. They felt no, you know, there was no shadow of a doubt, at least in the vast majority of volunteers, you know, that what they witnessed in the DMT state was more real than everyday reality. It just felt more real, which was a very strange thing, you know, to consider. You give a drug and what they see is more real than everything else. You know, so that was unexpected and striking. And I guess, you know, finally, the existence of the beings, those things with which the, you know, subjects interacted. You know, like I had smoked you know, DMT before, and I encountered beings, but I just figured, you know, that was me. And everybody I'd spoken to before this study began said, you know, be prepared for the beings. But I was not really, the volunteers were not really. So, you know, they were, you know, that was a, you know, surprising element that, you know, cropped up.
First of all, that's just the craziest shit. It really is. When exactly did psychedelics become illegal? And does that hurt your research? Like, hey, we're researching something, but it's illegal. When did it become illegal, and does it hurt you?
Well, yeah, like, you know, there was a lot of uncontrolled LSD use back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, conflated with, you know, the protests against the Vietnam War. So LSD, social unrest, the beginning of feminism, monks, burning themselves on fire to protest the war. Yeah, it was just, really crazy stuff. And there were a lot of people, taking a lot of LSD and ending up in the hospital, just because they were not that stable, or they, took it in the wrong place, or they took too much. So I think, there was a real public health issue, which was, coming to the fore. Like, what's this LSD drug, and why are people ending up in the hospital? Tim Leary didn't help by, telling people to, tune in and turn on and, drop out and overthrow the government and whatnot. So I think, people were just, freaking out at, the federal level, like, what the hell's going on? We have a problem. So they, in, 19 in 1970, they controlled the, they passed the Controlled Substances Act, which, created these schedules, Schedule 1, 2, 3, 4. And, they put the psychedelics into Schedule 1. So, so all, like, ongoing, studies wound down. People had to return their supply of drugs. And, the paperwork, just became impossible. Things, wound down in the early 70s. It's interesting, though, that animal studies, continued, and a lot of our understanding of the serotonin system, came about from the study of LSD in lower animals. Like, Prozac was, more or less developed, based on information, that LSD, helped, provide, about the serotonin system. So I was, faced with studying a Schedule 1, drug in humans, which had not been done in, 15, 18 years or so. So I just went through the paperwork, jumped through all the hoops. Took 2 years. I was patient. I had a beautiful wife and a beautiful house back then. I had a nice view, and I just thought, as long as they're not saying no, there's still a chance. It was pretty bizarre. There's one long, chapter in the DMT book, specifically about, how I got permission, because it's a, Kafka-esque, chapter. Some people, love that chapter, as and others, it, really gets them on edge.
Back to the stigma thing we were talking about before.
Oh, stigma, right?
I don't think the stigma's changed much surrounding psychedelics. It's becoming slightly more legal in little pockets around the, not legal, decriminalized at least. Do you think there's any chance they're ever going to change schedule-wise? That would get psychedelics out of Schedule One and into more of a usable schedule.
Oh, well, in a related manner, let me return to the question of any, stigma I experienced. It was, well, it, would depend on, the age of the researcher I would interact with. If it was an older researcher that had, done studies in the 50s, in the 60s, they were, kind of amused, like, oh no, not psychedelics again. That was, the feedback, that, oh my God, from the older generation of, psychopharmacologists. The younger, generation, my generation, back then, were a bit spooked, like, are you sure you want to be doing this? It's going to end your career. But they were interested, at the same time. Like, how in the world did you get this? And, like, how's it going? Yeah, but, they kept at arm's length, by and large. So I was just, working in Albuquerque, basically on my own, staying off the radar. Nobody was all that interested in coming on board, which was, like, in the beginning, good, so I could work out the kinks myself. But, in the end, it would have been, good to, have had some more colleagues. So legalization. Well, I think there needs to be increased access to treatments that seem to be useful. They may not have been completely double-blind, placebo-controlled, gold standard kind of, research design, like an FDA indication. But, the FDA, I think, could, suggests that there is strong evidence that psychedelic unassisted psychotherapy can be helpful. I think I want increased access, but I'm not all that keen on kind of widespread legalization. Like I was up in Denver a few months ago, and the scene up there with psychedelics, it's extreme. You can buy chocolate with a lot of psilocybin in it, just at these dispensaries. And the rails, the hand guards aren't quite, I think, in place. I think with that kind of increased accessibility, there might be some problems. But I think that for for conditions or for specific intent, I think increased access would be useful. Let's say for depression, even though there's still questions about specifics of using psychedelics for depression, it seems like it's helpful. But you would want skilled people screening your patients, giving the drug, supervising them, following up. But if it's just like you can get a sitter's permit with a couple of months of training, I don't think that's a good idea.
I think that
Even spiritual purposes, like if you want to use psychedelics to enhance your spiritual practice, you ought to be able to do that, but you ought to be able to do it safely, and with knowledgeable people around. So I think wholesale legalization, I'm not behind that, but I am interested in increased access. I think that would require a new schedule or like rescheduling the psychedelics, like 1A or something, or 2B or something like that. The drugs are still watched very carefully, but they're not so hard to get your hands on.
I think right now is, like you say, in the way it's decriminalized in Denver. I know in Vancouver, British Columbia, it's the same way. Like you're saying, there's storefronts selling mescaline, shrooms, DMT, and like vape carts and stuff. And I think that's the most dangerous area when it's in that gray area where it's not coming from a regulated source. You don't know if you're actually getting psilocybin in these, like you say, in the chocolate bars or. Because it is just an unregulated market where it's not illegal, but it's not legal and regulated yet. So I think that's the
Well, and
most
there,
dangerous area that it's in right now.
well, and there's no screening of the people that come in, to buy these things. Like, what if you're a schizophrenic who's been using methamphetamine, drinking, hasn't slept for a week, and they want to come in and buy some mushrooms? That's a recipe for, some problems. So, I think there needs to be, some guardrails.
Personal question with you, Rick. Do you still use psychedelics?
I took mushrooms that I got from Denver, actually, and some chocolate a couple of months ago.
Okay. Do you think everyone should be taking these? Me, nope. Okay. Not the extreme like you just gave, but me right now, normal dude who never tried anything, should I experience this in my life?
Well, I've never suggested anybody take drugs, and I'm going to stand by that.
My man.
If you want to take drugs, you should educate yourself as to how to get the most out of it and to keep yourself safe.
43 years, I'm still trying to read about weed. That's why I haven't tried it yet. One thing, you keep bringing up the things, the beings, and the theory that DMT facilitates near-death experiences, the things, aliens, beings. What are your thoughts on that? Like, is that in our brain? I know you kind of touched on it because it doesn't make sense. When my brother would keep telling me about it, I'm like, what do you mean everyone's taking this stuff and seeing kind of the same stuff? Is that in our brains or is that in the DMT? Is it a dream world? I'm kind of missing that area right there. Why is it so confusing and mind-blowing at the same time?
Yeah, how is it possible? Well, I mean, I think you're wondering about, where those beings reside. I mean, are they in our brains, and that, DMT is your brain on drugs and you're seeing things? Or is the brain's ability to perceive changed, and you can see things that are all around us normally but are unavailable or are invisible? So I just don't think we know. If you're a materialist, you would say it's your brain on drugs. That's no problem. And if you're a bit more kind of paranormal, psychic kinds of things, you would entertain the theory that, they're external, to us. And with respect, to the near-death experience, there is, some, similarity in descriptions of the DMT state with, the near-death state, which occurs like from a heart attack. There's also a lot of similarities between the near-death state and ketamine. In, both or in all, three of them, you're out of your body. You're interacting with, the contents of this freestanding, completely different world. So I was, mentioning the existence of DMT in the mammalian brain. Interestingly, if you kill an animal experimentally and you look at what's going on in the brain, the concentrations of DMT increase profoundly, especially in the visual cortex. So if in the dying state, the brain releases a ton more DMT, especially in the part of the brain mediating vision, it would be at least, supportive evidence that naturally occurring DMT, mediates, the visual components of the near-death state. Yeah, you,
When?
you know, so you, know, so you have to, kind of wonder, what is DMT doing in the brain in the first place? Like, if you're,
Yeah, why is it in us?
good question. And there's only one person in the world, as far as I know, John Dean at UC San Diego, who's, keen on looking at the production of DMT in the living human brain and, see if it's more active in dreams or in meditation or all kinds of things.
When did this resurgence of psychedelics come about? And maybe it's me being not in that world, but seeing you on Rogan talking about it, my brother telling about these books, Aaron Rodgers doing Enigma on Netflix talking about ayahuasca. When did this resurgence happen? Or has it always been there and I'm just late to the game?
Well, it was quietly percolating. Like, our study was the first in this country about 1 year before. There was a mescaline study in Germany, which was the first new European study. So our study at UNM, there was a a psilocybin OCD study in Phoenix, or in Tucson, a year or two after that. There was a couple MDMA studies, one at UCLA, one at Wayne State, and there was an ibogaine study in Florida. So all of those were with normal volunteers, low key psychopharmacology. But then the group at Hopkins published a mystical experience paper in, I think, 2005 or so. Like, you give psilocybin and you have a mystical experience. So that really got the interest going. And then Michael Pollan's book, which mostly discusses the mystical experience, research in Baltimore, really was a very popular book, and raised consciousness of these compounds to a lot greater extent. Joe Rogan, for sure, has talked about psychedelics, and especially about DMT. So our work was wrapped up in 95, and then it all, it was just, kind of quietly, perking along for another, maybe 10, 12 years, and then really took off.
Not more a question, more just an observation. Something we're talking about with the beings and like the DMT space, thinking about how like people use this stuff for thousands of years, if it's not smoked, but ayahuasca, different types of rituals, things like that. How crazy could you imagine seeing these things back in that time, seeing 2,000 years ago, seeing these beings and machinery and all that stuff? Like, that's the part that keeps getting to me, is that like shared experience that everybody's kind of seeing the same thing, and it's such a unique psychedelic on such a few different things, on its timing, and also tolerance wise, it's the only one that really doesn't build a tolerance, correct?
Right. And because of that, there are a couple of groups that have been looking at a long-term infusion of DMT. Like 30 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes, because of the lack of tolerance, you can keep people in that state for as long as you're giving the drug. And so, one of the, one of the aims of those long-term or those continuous infusion studies is, to characterize the DMT state a little more leisurely, because as you note, it really, well, if you smoke or injected it, comes and goes, so quickly. With respect to what ayahuascaros or people using ayahuasca in the Amazon have been, seeing for, thousands of years, I think, they would use the images or the, parts of images which are already in their, mental repository. So they wouldn't, see a car, let's say 1,000 years ago, but they would see a dragon or a big bird or a huge lizard, which would, convey, more or less the same, feeling and the same information which a car might, nowadays.
Okay, that's the part that got me. Like, 'cause imagining them seeing, like saying these futuristic things. For us, it's even futuristic, but seeing that thousands of years ago would be even more crazy.
I think, the nature of the visions were consistent with what, they were seeing in everyday
Okay,
life.
that makes a lot more sense.
Rick, I've had you on for 50 minutes. Unfortunately, we didn't hit the 3 hour mark. Ready to finish up with some ready to finish up with some quick hit questions.
Sure.
What show are you binge watching right now?
Two of them, actually. Well, Severance. The whole world's watching Severance. And we're watching Adolescence, and White Lotus.
White Lotus, I'm obsessed with. I'll be texting you after the next two episodes. Who do you think is going to die at the end? If one person had to die, who do you think?
It could be Gary, the sleaze bag.
Yeah, Greg Gary. That's who I think that's the easiest pick, but I think that's what's going to happen too.
Well, it would be, it would be karmic, but the world often doesn't, seem to run on karma.
Yeah, and Mike White doesn't usually play around with that. 2:30 in the morning, Rick comes home late night. What is your go-to 2:30 snack to eat?
Yogurt.
Really, that's an interesting one. Any kind of specific yogurt?
Greek with some strawberry jam as I think about
You're going to have it in a little bit. How about this?
it.
What book are you reading right now? You reading anything?
Oh, I just, finished an amazing book. Let me show it to
Yeah,
you.
I want to see it.
Yeah, it's quite a book. I mean, I recommend it, but I'm not sure. It's, wide range. No
No
Road
Rules.
Leading Back by Chris Heath.
Premise of it, what's the book about?
Well, it's a deep investigative journalistic, dive into Honar, which was a little like Hamlet in the Lithuanian forest near Vilna during World War II. And 80,000 Jews were shot and dumped into pits in Ponar by the Nazis and by the Lithuanians. It's a story of 12 people who escaped living at Ponar, whose job was to dig up all the corpses and burn them in order to not leave any evidence, if the Nazis lost the war.
Oh, that's heavy.
Oh man, it is one of the most heavy books I've ever read. But the guy does a beautiful job. He tracks down as many of the relatives of as many of the escapees as he can. It's really quite a meticulous piece of work. That took me a couple of weeks to read. The first part is about what life was like at Ponar. And it's really kind of grim. The second and third parts of the book are, the stories of the escapees, what happened after they returned to normal life, and how the story has kind of come and gone from the eye of the media. It just came out last year, so it kind of stirring up some old controversy again.
Yeah, maybe you need to read something a little lighter next one. Don't go back-to-back heavy books, all right, Rick?
Well, that's what my wife is always giving me a hard time about. Why don't you read something light?
That's my wife. I read all true crime books. She's like, all right, let's read something good. All right,
Right.
last two, Rick. I think I know the answer to this, but you come to New York, you and I are in a bar. Who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you back?
The coolest person in my phone.
Yeah, actually, a name drop here.
Yeah, I don't want a name drop. It would be my wife, I guess. I mean, she's the coolest person I know.
And you have the awesome new book, My Altered States, A Doctor's Extraordinary Account of Trauma, Psychedelics, and Spiritual Growth. You have, of course, DMT, The Spirit Molecule. Are you on tour, doing any speaking engagements, doing anything else for this book?
Not really. It came out in... mid-December, and I've been, marketing it. I was just on, the Danny Jones podcast, last week from Tampa. Yeah, and I think after, this one, I'm going to be probably, taking a break, from interviews for a while. I have another, project that I'm working on that I want, to dedicate, more time to. Let me show, the copy or, the cover of the book.
Of course.
My Altered States. Yeah, it's an illustrated memoir. A friend from Birmingham, Alabama.
It's a beautiful picture, too.
Yeah, Merrilee Chalice from Birmingham, did the illustrations. Yeah, it's a fun, illustrations, cool book. I think, add a lot. Yeah, so... so I'm on X now, finally.
Well, plug it, because everybody wants to know where they can find you. Obviously, get the books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere else. Give the plug for your website and X. I'm excited that you're on X. I'm going to follow you right when we finish this up.
Great. I'll follow you right back. You too, Jason.
I'm not on X. I don't do the social.
What's your name on X, Rick?
Rick_Strassman.
I will follow you. But Rick, before we finish up, I got a funny quick story for you about you coming on and how unprepared I was initially. So traveling is the most important thing in my life besides sports. I'm obsessed with traveling, trying to visit every country in the world. So right before I emailed you, my brother's like, you have to get Rick Strassman on. I'm obsessed with him. He was on Rogan. He wrote this book. I can't put it down. Tell me everything about DMT. I'm like, you got it. I'll email him. So I throw you an email. I forget I email you. And Rick Steves is a travel guy, is coming out with a book on the hippie trail. So I emailed him to come on the show. Like 2 days later, I get an email from Rick. And it says, Rick would love to come on the show. Are you free March 25th? I'm like, hell yeah. So I text my three travel friends, like the guys I travel with. I'm like, bro, Rick Steves is coming on. The OG of travel. The next thing was, I guess your PR person, who's awesome. She's great. She's like, hey, I'm going to send you a copy of the book. I'm like, great. I don't have to buy the hippie trail. I click it and I'm like, what kind of cover is this? And I'm like, holy shit. So Rick, thank God I did a follow up because I would have asked you about traveling to Amsterdam in 73.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, it's like, kind of a common name, or it used to be anyway, Rick.
Yes, Rick, I'll be honest. For me, this was an absolute blast. It was so different for me to step out of my comfort zone instead of talking about sports and reading and everything and travel to speak about a world I know nothing about. You broke it down and dumbed it down for me. You made me more intrigued. I can retire from work any day now, and you might be the guy I call to do my first trip with, as I sound so uncool saying that, bro. So, Rick, the first book is great. I'm excited for the second book. I'm excited to see what you got next, man. I just want to thank you so much for coming on, man.
Okay. Well, thanks, Michael and Jason. It was a blast.
And I'll follow you on Twitter now, brother. Nice meeting you, man.
Okay. See ya. Okay. Bye.
Be good, bro.
Bye-bye.
Bye.